service.
Disgraceland is brought to you by Disgraceland All Access. Disgraceland All Access membership is your chance to support the show and get ad-free listening, an exclusive scripted episode every month, and exclusive bonus content every week, plus access to an always-on chat with me and your fellow discos. Visit disgracelandpod.com/membership and sign up today. Hey guys, this is Jake, and I want to tell you about a brand new podcast from my company Double Elvis in collaboration with Volume.com called The Singer's Talk. This show is based on the book of the same name written by Jason Thomas Gordon, the singer and drummer for the LA rock band King Size. And just like the book, The Singer Talk podcast features in-depth, illuminating conversations with some of the most iconic singers of all time, discussing the one thing they're never asked about, their voices. So whether you're a singer or a music fan, you're going to get a wild inside look at how your favorite vocalists approach singing live and in the studio. This is a fascinating podcast. These are raw, intimate conversations with incredible artists like Tom York, Norah Jones, Roger Daltrey, Geddy Lee, and so many more. Also, interviews with bandmates and producers of singers that are no longer with us, like Prince, Janis Joplin, Chris Cornell, and Nina Simone. That's The Singer's Talk. You can search for it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, you know the drill, wherever you get your podcasts. Give it a follow or check it out on volume.com/The Singer's Talk.
Disgraceland is a production of Double Elvis.
The stories about the Wu-Tang Clan's the Jizza are insane. He may be the only rapper who lectures about quantum physics at Ivy League institutions, including Harvard and MIT. That honor stems from his acknowledged role as the genius, the so-called Voltron head of hip-hop's most notorious group. A group that was targeted by the most hated man in America, after that same man bought their one-of-a-kind album at auction for $2 million. A group that nearly crumbled under the weight of resentment, acrimony, and lawsuits. A group whose past continued to come back to haunt them, particularly when Staten Island's undisputed drug kingpins went on trial after a nearly 20-year reign of fear and violence. A group that made great music. Music made even greater and more profound by the presence of the Jizza. Unlike that clip I played for you at the top of the show, that wasn't great music. That was a preset loop from my Mellotron called Life Moves Pretty Fast, MK1. I played you that clip because I can't afford the rights to Hello by Adele. And why would I play you that specific slice of From the Other Side cheese, could I afford it? Because that was the number one song in America on December 17th, 2015. And that was the day that the Federal Bureau of Investigation made an early morning arrest in New York City after a prolonged investigation. An arrest that sent a shock through the Wu-Tang world. On this episode, quantum physics, Ivy League institutions, the most hated man in America, From the Other Side cheese, and Wu-Tang Clan's the Jizza. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is Disgraceland. Few people living in New York City in the 1970s were as uniquely prepared for the dawn of rap music as Gary Grice, the boy the world would later know as the Jizza. But young Jizza, aka the genius, aka young Gary here, didn't know that he was uniquely prepared for anything. All he knew were rhymes. The nursery rhymes in his Mother Goose book that he memorized as a kid. the Rhymes on Records by the spoken word group The Last Poets. He listened to those over and over, repeating every verse, every inflection, every cadence. He mashed both worlds together in his head. Poems for kids and poems for adults. Two halves of one brain. On one side, Humpty Dumpty, all broken up but no one to put him back together again. On the other side, Jesus Christ himself, standing on the corner of Lenox and 125th, trying to catch the first cab out of Harlem. You know, when the revolution comes. When the revolution did come, when Curtis Blow dropped The Breaks in 1980, and Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five hit the R&B chart in 1982 with The Message, Gary, now a teenager, his head flowing with verses by local MCs like Spoonie G and Eddie Chiba, understood better than most what he was hearing. Hip-hop made sense. It was a language he was already speaking, the style he was already living. The hip-hop ciphers that broke out on street corners and block parties were all about inclusion. The ciphers were circles, and circles were made to be unbroken. They brought people together, people who had no other options, no voice, like the punks across the pond in England. They had no future, until now. Hip-hop made something out of nothing. Hip-hop triumphed over adversity. It brought meaning to the absurdity of life, and thus brought life to burnt-out and deteriorating buildings in the South Bronx projects, where Gary here spent the summers with his father. The South Bronx was ground zero for hip-hop. DJs rolled up, plugged their huge speakers into a random light pole on the street, hijacked electricity, and started spinning. And next, a dude just jumped on the mic, and then another dude challenged the first dude. It was all about standing your ground, proving your worth, mastering your flow. Gary took that flow with him to his mom's place, first on Staten Island, and later in Brooklyn. On paper, Staten Island was just another borough, but it was not the Bronx. And this being the late 70s and early 80s, news traveled as slow as the Staten Island ferry. So Gary's cousin, Bobby Diggs, aka the RZA, got hip to the flow before the rest of Staten Island only because Gary brought it to him. Hip-hop blew Bobby's mind. Between the Kung Fu movies and now rap music, Bobby didn't sleep much. Who needed sleep? Along with their third cousin, Russell Jones, aka Ason Unique, aka Old Dirty Bastard, the cousins just wanted to walk the streets at all hours and look for a cipher. A circle of other MCs dropping freestyles off the top of their domes. Ciphers were where you learned. Ciphers were where you picked a fight. Not physically, but with your words, with your rhymes, with your flow. Gary learned quick. Soon, he was like the lone wolf in Shogun Assassin. Only if the lone wolf wasn't alone, but instead had a wolf pack. And this wasn't the peaceful Edo period in Japan. This was New York in the 1980s. Muggers, murderers, thieves, and dope fiends were behind every corner. Fear City was not for the faint of heart. You had to be sharp in your words, your delivery, your confidence. It had to be Wusthof, some cheap Ginzu shit. The rush you got when you brought fire to the cipher, when you were funky, cool, confident, like butter, or better yet, like mercury, both liquid and metal at the same time, that rush was incredible. Nothing felt better. Gary loved that feeling, so he did it more. He battled, he learned, he got better, and soon he was coming in for the kill. A choice verse was like a broadsword to the chest. In, out, a couplet here, a rhyme there, knees buckled and blood ran red. He was ruthless. He sliced necks. He cut heads. And the heads rolled. But as the decade rolled on and rap music gained commercial traction, the genre was increasingly vilified by those who didn't understand it the way Gary did. Tipper Gore, a Democrat senator's wife from Tennessee, led the charge at the Parents Music Resource Center. We have the PMRC to thank for those parental advisory stickers, as well as the erroneous claim that rap simply glorified violence and degraded women. In 1988, Paulus Queens' own Run DMC held a press conference to blast the media and come to Rap's defense after a fan died at a hip-hop show at the Nassau Coliseum. Writing about that show, the New York Times described rap music as, quote, a rhymed chant to an electronically produced beat, unquote, and reported that the violence at this particular show was, and I also quote, the latest in a wave that seems to follow rap performances almost as closely as its fans decked out in gold chains. That wasn't what hip-hop was about at all. Not to Gary, it wasn't. Hip-hop was lyrical. It came from the streets, sure, but it also came from the heart, from the depths of your imagination. It was poetry and mathematics, Mother Goose and Last Poets. It didn't have to be about your life. It could be about anything. It was multidimensional, cosmic. Rap was dust and stars. And in Gary's hands, rap was straight up genius. But genius isn't recognized by everyone. Mediocrity is much easier to spot. And thus, mediocrity dominates the conversation. It turns out, mediocrity wants to rule the world.
Okay, listen, if you're one of the few people out there who's new to podcasts, new to Disgraceland, new to true crime, if you have not already listened to the wildly popular and hysterically funny and informative podcast, My Favorite Murder, hosted by my friends Karen Kilgariff and Georgia Hardstark on the Exactly Right Network, then what are you waiting for? You got to check out My Favorite Murder. In each episode, they're going to tell you stories about infamous serial killers, cold cases, incredible survivor stories. And listen, these guys are wildly popular for a reason. They have an incredible chemistry. They're hysterical. They're smart as all get up. And you're instantly going to feel like they're long lost friends. They've got great new episodes on the subjects I've already mentioned, but they've got this whole treasure trove of back episodes, including well-known stories from true crime and music history, like the deaths of Sid Vicious and Nancy Spungen, the murder of pop singer Selena, and now the infamous story of the Cocaine Bear. I've known Karen and Georgia since the beginning of my sort of foray into podcasting. They've been heroes of mine. I was on their podcast in March of 2022 to share my hometown story about a prison break party that I attended in high school. And they told me it was one of their most popular episodes. So you can check that out as well. Listen to My Favorite Murder wherever you listen to podcasts. Brand new episodes drop every Thursday. Hey, Discos, it's Jake here. Thank you so much for listening to Disgraceland. Your support truly means a lot to me, and it's because of you that my team and I are able to make this show. If you want more Disgraceland, if you want more regular interactions with me and the community of Disgraceland listeners, or if you simply want to listen to the show ad-free, go to disgracelandpod.com/membership. For just $5 a month, you can listen to every episode of Disgraceland ad-free. Plus, you'll get one brand new exclusive episode every month. You'll also get weekly unscripted bonus content, special audio collections, and early access to merch and events. There are two ways that you can support the show and become a member at disgracelandpod.com/membership. You can sign up using Patreon and listen to the show ad-free on Apple, Spotify, and most other major podcast platforms. And Patreon members also get access to all the other perks of membership and an always-on chat where I'll be interacting with you and diving deeper into the world of Disgraceland. But maybe you're currently an Apple Podcast subscription listener and you want to just tap into all the bonus audio content and ad-free listening that we're offering. We're also offering this membership as a premium channel on Apple Podcasts. However you choose to join, all you got to do is go to disgracelandpod.com/membership. Support the show for just $5 a month, $5, or sign up for an annual plan and get 2 months free. Come join me and your fellow discos at Disgraceland All Access by visiting disgracelandpod.com/membership. Hey, Discos, jumping in here quickly to tell you about a new giveaway that we put together especially for Disgraceland fans. Listen to this. We teamed up with our friends at Tivoli Audio and D'Angelico Guitar, two legendary brands in audio, to award one of you a prize pack that includes the all-new Tivoli Audio songbook paired with a limited edition D'Angelico electric guitar. The songbook is an incredible vintage-inspired sound system, and you can plug your D'Angelico guitar right into it. It's also got an analog EQ and a 10-hour rechargeable battery so you can take your music and your favorite podcast anywhere. Go to DisgracelandContest.com to see the prize pack and drop your email address to enter for free. Must be a U.S. resident to win. Visit DisgracelandContest.com for full details. That's DisgracelandContest.com. Rock and roll.
Martin Shkreli had something that no one else had. Wu-Tang Clan's seventh studio album. Once Upon a Time in Shaolin was one of a kind. A singular copy had been made. Just literally one copy. Two compact discs housed in a silver jewel-encrusted box with a wax Wu-Tang seal and liner notes bound in leather. There was, quite literally, nothing else in the world like it. It wasn't just music, it was art. It was 2016. The year prior, Shkreli put up $2 million at auction to own the world's rarest album. He paid more money for Once Upon a Time in Shaolin than anyone had paid for an album in history. $2 million. That's nuts. It's fucking crazy. For Shkreli, though, it was a drop in the bucket. He had that kind of money, or at least, he made it look like he had that kind of money. His parents worked hard for their money. Immigrants who came to Brooklyn and found work pushing brooms. Definition of working class. Not entirely unlike the guys in Wu-Tang. And also not unlike a lot of the guys in Wu-Tang, Shkreli dropped out of high school to hustle. But he didn't hustle dice games like Method Man. And he didn't hustle crack like U-God, Raekwon, and Deck. Shkreli had a different hustle. The stock market. Incredibly, he was buying shares of a little company called Amazon at just 15 years old. He interned for Wall Street hedge funds before he was 21. He grew tall by short-selling biotech stocks. He played huge risks and used the art of bullshit to cover his ass when those risks didn't pay off. His pharmaceutical company infamously bought the rights to market Daraprim, a drug used by AIDS patients. Shkreli immediately raised the cost from $12.50 to $750. And that's over 5,000% per pill. The Daily Beast labeled Shkreli the most hated man in America. And it wasn't just his wealth, or his greed, or his bullshit, or the fact that he made a life-saving drug next to impossible for sick people to afford. It was his smirk. The shit-eating grin he flashed every time he was on the news sent a very clear message. He may be despised and he may be a scam artist, but one thing could not be denied. He was untouchable. Every time he smirked, he confirmed this. Very entitled, very smug, and very safe up in his white-collar tower. "What's my name?" his smirk seemed to say. "Fuck you. That's my name." It was the same smirk he was flashing now in a video posted online, flanked by three men wearing masks over their faces. Shkreli gave the patented insufferable smirk as he addressed one particular member of the hip-hop group whose one-of-a-kind album he just purchased. "Dennis, I'm gonna call you by your government name. You're not a ghost face killer, I'm sorry. You're an old man that's lost his relevance, and you're trying to reclaim a spotlight from my spotlight. And that's not okay. Most people don't even try to beef with me. You know why? Because nobody's that dumb. And for whatever reason, you think that's okay to beef with me. That's a big mistake." Shkreli, of course, was addressing Ghostface Killa, aka Dennis Coles, who called Shkreli a shithead when TMZ asked him to comment on the buyer of Wu-Tang's unprecedented work of art. Ghost wasn't wrong. He told his truth. But hearing that truth pushed Shkreli over the edge. His verbal missive online turned downright threatening. "I'm gonna erase you from the record books of rap. I butter your bread, you understand me? Without me, you're nothing. Stop acting, stop pretending, stop lying. Be real. And don't ever fucking mention my name again, or there will be more of a price to pay than just this video. Shkreli's threats may have phased a weaker person, but not Ghostface. In fact, Ghost could not wait to respond to that fake-ass supervillain's video. And my God, man, did he respond. Google Ghost's 11-minute video in which he destroys the pharma bro with humor and heart and the help of his sister and his mother, but I digress. It's reasonable, however, to think that Ghost and the rest of Wu-Tang were aware of and perhaps concerned with the unspoken threat in play. You could laugh all you wanted at Shkreli's weak thug act, but you could not deny this, that a man could be so entitled, so untouchable, so above the law, that he could take whatever he wanted. Didn't matter if Ghost could out-diss him or the Jizza could out-genius him, this guy had money, influence, and power, just like the PMRC back in the day. Today, it was a silver jewel-encrusted box, and tomorrow, it could be everything else.
We'll be right back after this word.
Jizza was pissed. He knew he was getting fucked. And they were all getting fucked. Kid Capri, Granddaddy, IU, Cool G Rap, Master Ace. Each given a $25 per diem on this 10-city promotional tour while the sponsor, their record label, Cold Chillin', was pulling down $60,000 a night. 60 grand. Now that was cold. It was also a wake-up call. The labels, the music industry at large, they didn't care about you. They only cared about how you could make money for them. And also, they cared about keeping as much of that money from you as possible. Jizza, just 24 years old, wide-eyed, optimistic, hungry, was about to be taught a major lesson in how the world really worked. Cold Chillin', the label, was not going to change Jizza's life. He was going to have to find another way. 1991, 1 year before the dawn of Wu-Tang. Jizza was still going by his original stage name, The Genius. His Cold Chillin' record solo debut, Words from the Genius, was barely making a dent. To be completely honest, it tanked. Very few people heard it, lost out there somewhere between the Tone Lokes and the NWAs and the Public Enemies. Jizza gave it his all. He poured his heart and soul into every line on every track. Cold Chillin' poured it all down the drain. In Jizza's eyes, they didn't give him a chance. They didn't give his promotional budget enough zeros. And now they're offering him this, mere pennies on the dollar while they raked in the big bucks. Jizza may have been young, but he knew a screw job when he saw one. Not that life as an undervalued Cold Chillin' artist was unique. Far from it. Like Hunter S. Thompson once said, the entertainment world is a quote, long plastic hallway where thieves and pimps run free and good men die like dogs for no good reason, unquote. He was actually talking about the television industry, but it tracks for the music biz too. These recording deals were almost always made by young artists desperate to change their reality. And desperation will make you do just about anything. And in the case of guys like Jizza and his brothers in Wu-Tang, a record deal meant they were doing the impossible. They were making something of their lives. A record deal meant you could stop running, stop dealing, stop living hand to mouth. Thus, it was easy to sign on the dotted line, but even easier to feel like a dupe when you realized you'd been played. Thing is, getting played wasn't something that was exclusive to an artist's formative years. Cold Chillin' wouldn't be the only time Jizza was gonna do the math and scratch his head. Hey Dirty Baby, I got your money, was a line that the RZA likely never uttered, but Old Dirty Bastard's 1999 hit single was allegedly written about RZA and how he initially balked at letting ODB out of his Wu-Tang contract. As we covered in an earlier episode, that sentiment was echoed by many in the group who said they didn't have an easy time parting ways with Wu-Tang Productions. Additionally, U-God claimed in his autobiography that RZA's deep knowledge of the music industry put the rest of the group at a distinct disadvantage. From what I can tell, he got rich, U-God wrote, but I still don't know what I'm due. This confusion and resentment never went away. It bubbled up time and again, and most notably around the creation of Once Upon a Time in Shaolin. The one-of-a-kind album sold to pharma bro Martin Shkreli in 2015. An album which U-God called, quote, some sucker shit, pure and simple, unquote. Raekwon agreed. In his own book, Ray called what went down during the making of that album as, quote, some of the dirtiest shit I've ever heard of. Once Upon a Time in Shaolin was conceived by Silver Rinks, a Dutch Moroccan rapper and producer originally discovered by ODB and Method Man and signed to Wu-Tang Records by RZA. The concept of a single copy of a single album sold to a single buyer was, of course, the end result of the increasingly worthless nature of all recorded music, most of which is now given away for next to nothing. But Silver Rings' idea was not exactly a new one. It harkens back to the golden age of classical music, when music was not just art, but work, and work was time, and time was money. Back when composers like Bach, Beethoven, and Mozart, to name a few, were put on retainer, were hired outright by wealthy patrons or royalty to make their music, according to the market, and they were fairly compensated. But there was only one Mozart, not a clan of Mozarts, and that's where the problem with Once Upon a Time in Shaolin starts. The problem of fair compensation. Depending on which member of Wu-Tang you ask, they were either compensated very little or not at all for this album. And they were compensated very little or not at all for random verses they laid down here and there. Verses they weren't even aware were being used for a new Wu-Tang record. A record that was produced in secret. A record that sold for $2 million. And where was that money going, they wanted to know. At every step, Wu-Tang were kept in the dark. Even when the album went up for auction, most of the guys in the group had never heard it. Wu-Tang weren't the only ones complaining. The artist who created the intricate silver box said he never got paid either. Hey, Silver Rings, baby, you got my money? And the question was asked in vain. Silver Rings wasn't answering. He wasn't in Shaolin anymore. So the disgruntled artist went after whoever he could track down. He sued some of the guys in Wu-Tang, who, as it turns out, were busy suing Wu-Tang Productions. After the biggest sale in the history of recorded music, Wu-Tang Clan was splintering. The lawsuits, the acrimony, the resentment. It was the perfect moment for a guy like Martin Shkreli to weasel his way in and take advantage of the crumbling foundation. But Shkreli wasn't the only one Wu-Tang had to worry about. Because just as the group was attempting to sort out what would become of their future, their past was working overtime trying to catch up to them. Rennell Wilson shot the first detective in the back of the head at point-blank range. He didn't know the cop had two sons waiting for him at home. Not that it would have mattered. The other detective sitting inside the unmarked police car begged for his life while the first one bled out on his seat. He had three kids, for Christ's sake. And he told Wilson he'd give him whatever he wanted. He wouldn't say shit about any of this. Just don't kill him. Not here. Not now. Wilson wasn't listening. All his life, he'd known chaos and hardship. He saw plenty of foster homes and psych evals, but no happy endings. Ever. The only thing that mattered in life was getting what you wanted, by any means necessary. And right now, Wilson wanted two things. First, the $1,200 that the undercover detectives were carrying for this botched buy and bust operation. And second, no witnesses. He pointed his pistol at the whimpering detective and pulled the trigger. Then, he dumped the two lifeless bodies in the middle of a Staten Island street and drove off into the night with the cash. NYPD arrested Wilson 2 days later. They found some remedial rap lyrics he scribbled on a piece of paper, bragging about being a cop killer two times over. Hip-hop and death, not so strange bedfellows. Two constants in the shithole of a city. So went the thinking by members of law enforcement anyway. Rennell Wilson didn't give a damn what the cops thought. He had no regrets and no remorse. And the prosecution told the jury that only a man with no remorse didn't take the stand. And so the jury sentenced Wilson to die. This was in 2007. 3 years later, Wilson's sentence was overturned by a federal appellate panel. The prosecution had violated Wilson's right not to testify when they told the jury that stuff about remorse and testifying. Didn't matter if that sentiment was ultimately true or not. The law was the law. Back in Park Hill, Staten Island, where the law was anyone's guess, Wilson's temporary reversal of fortune was cause for celebration. Wilson's fellow sympathizers in the Bloods partied in a parking lot, including Anthony and Harvey Christian, aka the Christian Brothers, aka the undisputed kingpins of the Park Hill drug trade for close to two decades now. I should say that the Christian Brothers allegedly celebrated a cop killer's stay of execution, as this detail was provided in the sworn testimony of one of their former associates, who, in 2014, turned snitch for the feds when the Christian Brothers were arrested and put on trial. Anthony and Harvey Christian were accused of running a feared and violent enterprise, charged with racketeering, firearms possession, multiple counts of drug trafficking, and murder conspiracies, including, in the case of Anthony Christian, the murder of a man named Jerome Boo Boo Estrella. Now, if the name Jerome Estrella sounds familiar to you, it should. You may remember him from our previous episode of Disgraceland about Mastakilla. Estrella was the Bloods member murdered in 1999, a murder that, at the time, the feds were trying to pin on Wu-Tang Clan. Reason being that Estrella had supposedly robbed the RZA's little brother, and according to testimony from former gang members turned snitches, the murder was payback, alleged to have been ordered by Wu-Tang. Of course, the FBI's designation of Wu-Tang Clan as a major crime organization was old news. Their five-year investigation was closed shut, had been, for a decade. Their file, which made connections between the hip-hop group and numerous murders, not to mention the never-ending transgressions of Old Dirty Bastard, was stashed deep in the bowels of a government building. Case closed. But nothing is ever truly closed. The past is never truly dead. It's only a matter of time before it wakes up again. Sometimes, though, it wakes up in Steubenville, other times on Staten Island. Once, it woke up at the House of Blues in Los Angeles when a Crip tried to put a piece in Method Man's hand after the notorious B.I.G. was gunned down. And now, in a high-profile case involving two of New York City's most dangerous drug kingpins, it woke up again. Anthony Christian's lawyer heard about the FBI's file on Wu-Tang Clan. He demanded to see it. What if the Bureau's cold case had hot legs? Or what if all that existing due diligence could actually clear Anthony Christian's name? What I'm trying to ascertain, the lawyer said, is the FBI's stated belief in an official file that Wu-Tang ordered this homicide. He wasn't suggesting that Wu-Tang committed a crime. The FBI had gone ahead and done that already. Thursday, December 17th, 2015, 6 a.m. New York City was still shrouded in darkness when the knock came at the apartment door. And then, another. Finally, the door opened. Federal agents wearing neatly pressed suits with guns at their hips and badges around their necks flooded inside. The man inside the apartment was barely awake. Or maybe he'd never gone to sleep the night before. It was hard to tell with the ones who lived outside the law for so long. The lead agent told the man to put his hands behind his back, and the man did as he was told, and the agent got out his handcuffs. He locked them tight around the man's wrists and began to read him his rights. The agent led the man to the front door of the apartment building and out into the tree-lined streets of Murray Hill. The sun was struggling to come up. A crowd of reporters struggled to get a quote. The man wasn't talking. His gray hoodie was pulled over his head. He didn't say a word. He just let the feds walk him to where an unmarked car idled on the side of the street. And then he quietly ducked inside. After a prolonged investigation, after years of surveillance and COs and dead-end leads, of knowing in their guts that they were right, the FBI finally had vindication. They made an arrest, and they had their guy. But this was not a member of Wu-Tang being led away by the FBI. The man in cuffs wasn't Ghostface Killa. Nor was it the RZA or the JZA. It was Martin Shkreli. Shkreli's perp walk was broadcast on every major network. It was headline news. The feds had an avalanche of evidence against him. As one agent put it, Shkreli was being charged with the securities fraud trifecta of lies, deceit, and greed. Martin Shkreli's sudden fall from a smug untouchable to a disgraced con man was satisfying to watch for most, not least of all Wu-Tang Clan. He'd defrauded investors and stole millions, and now everything was being taken away from him, including the $2 million album, which was sitting in a temperature-controlled room at the Department of Justice. Wu-Tang, meanwhile, were cleared of any wrongdoing in the eyes of the federal government. Drug kingpin Anthony Christian and his lawyer tried for a year to get the FBI's Wu-Tang case reopened, but were unsuccessful. The Christian brothers were eventually found guilty on all charges. Harvey Christian received a 50-year sentence, while Anthony, who was also found guilty of the murder of Jerome Boo Boo Estrella, got life. And Martin Shkreli got 7 years for fraud. Ghostface Killa, the Method Man, got a photo with James Comey, former FBI director, backstage at a taping of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Ghost posted it on his Instagram. The U.S. government eventually resold Once Upon a Time in Shaolin in order to satisfy the balance of Martin Shkreli's debt. It was purchased by a group of NFT collectors called Pleaser DAO. Don't ask me to properly pronounce that or to explain decentralized organizations or non-fungible tokens. I'm not going to do it, but I am going to tell you that they paid twice what Shkreli paid for it. Per the terms of the original sale, public release of the album is forbidden until the year 2103. And JZA, aka the genius, aka the man RZA once called the head of Wu-Tang's Voltron Assembly, was standing at the podium in a lecture hall at MIT. At first, it felt funny to be there, like he was a man out of place, like maybe he should stay in his lane. But this was his lane. Thought, imagination, expression. No matter if it was in the classroom or on the street corner. All of it was cosmic. Everything was connected by dust and stars. Words themselves were electrically charged, and electrical charges made up subatomic particles. Something like that. He was still learning. Since he was a little kid, he never stopped learning. But now, in addition to battling rappers in a cipher back in the neighborhood, he was trading thoughts with marine biologists and astrophysicists. And just think, him, Gary Grice, a kid from the South Bronx, from Brooklyn, from Staten Island, a kid obsessed with hip-hop, that musical form once derided by the public and misrepresented by the media. He was here now as an ambassador of that music and that culture, at the forefront of higher education, waxing existential to college students about quantum physics, about time and space. But mostly about rap music. How he'd been there for the Big Bang back in the 70s, and now how he was here, over 4 decades later, still watching the so-called globalization of hip-hop take over the entire world. From New York all the way to Japan, Europe, Africa, and everywhere in between. Just like hip-hop, JZA could not and would not stop. From MIT, he went to NYU, and then from NYU to Harvard, and from Harvard to Oxford. He didn't want to rule the world, and there were enough mediocre people already trying to do that. The Martin Shkrelis and the FBIs and the Christian brothers. He was just trying to understand it. How so many were content to wallow in mediocrity, but yet had so much promise for genius. How the years were long and the challenges were deep. And there was tragedy, and there was triumph, and there were moments that burned bright. And there were times when, as JZA explained about the current status of Wu-Tang, that match burns out. But there was always light somewhere. The cipher was never completely broken. Nothing was ever truly over. After all, the universe was expanding. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is Disgraceland.
Disgraceland was created by yours truly and is produced in partnership with Double Elvis. Credits for this episode can be found on the show notes page at disgracelandpod.com. If you're listening as a Disgraceland All Access member, thank you for supporting the show. We really appreciate it. And if not, you can become a member right now by going to disgracelandpod.com/membership. Members can listen to every episode of Disgraceland ad-free. Plus, you'll get one brand new exclusive episode every month, weekly unscripted bonus episodes, special audio collections, and early access to merchandise and events. Visit disgracelandpod.com/membership for details. Rate and review the show and follow us on Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, and Facebook at disgracelandpod and on YouTube at youtube.com/@disgracelandpod. Rock-a-rolla.